afternoon. You're joining the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
What's up? I'm Bob Martin.
And we're here on Easter afternoon. It's lovely. With our impromptu guest, Mr. William Kay, who is out of the province, now that I've gotten my word province back.
Yeah.
Province of Alberta, Canada. But, oh, Bill's got the commercial, bro.
Oh, yeah.
Look at you guys. Look at you guys. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Powerhouse Solar,
gonna
our
run right
sponsor
by
for this hour. Powerhouse Solar will do anything you want solar. They can do it. I don't care if it's cutting your energy bill, heating up your swimming pool.
And Lord knows, when you live in Reading and you're only 2 miles from the sun.
That's right.
Cutting the energy bill in the summer is a big deal.
Gosh, yes. We had like...
Well, we used to be 2 miles from the sun.
Yeah.
Are we closer now?
I don't know. I haven't seen enough sun in the last 6 months to give you a definite answer.
Well, let me check with... I'll check with Bruce and Sue on that when they can give us a read on what they're getting on those solar panels, because I think they'd be the people to know.
Yeah, they would.
So, yeah, Powerhouse Solar.
Well,
call them at 530-275-5600 or get them on the web at powerhousesolar.com. Yeah, they can do anything for you, solar, and they're great folks.
And that's all they do.
So that's all they do. They've been around a long time.
I don't know what other people do that are doing solar, but it kind of makes it sound like maybe they're doing dog grooming or something on the side. I'm not sure what that's all about.
Yeah, I don't know, but I see these guys everywhere.
They are everywhere.
They are busy.
Nice.
Yeah, so there you have it.
Yeah, because as we head into summer, there's nothing funny about our sun exposure around here. It's very serious.
Oh, but it's a great opportunity to bank your solar power for the months ahead.
I mean, at our old house, all joking aside, because it wasn't funny, our power bill in the summer was $800.
Yeah, our neighbor's was $900
that air every
conditioner.
Month.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Yeah, it was horrible.
How hot's it get up where you are, William?
What
does Alberta do in the summer? Does it get hot?
These prairie cities are the nicest place in the world in the summertime.
Like what's your like top temperature in the summer? What's normal?
Well, we're Celsius here. We're not Fahrenheit, but it would be the equivalent. I've seen it go, you know, like 105 to 110 Fahrenheit, but that's pretty unusual. What you get a lot of are, you know, strings of, you know, 2 weeks at a time where it's 80 to 90 and you can't find a cloud. You're in the middle of a sapphire dome.
Oh, hold on now.
That's kind of nice.
Are you telling me you don't even have
here
chemtrails or anything up there? Come on.
Chemtrails.
Oh.
Well, only when John McCain flies over.
Yeah. Good one. Oh my gosh. So what do you think, you know, with all of this, you know, now obviously we've sent a totally different signal to the world with our foreign policy than than was talked about on the campaign trail. So we've kind of established that part. So back into your wheelhouse, what do you think that does for all this environmental overreach with the global warming and all that stuff?
Well, the danger is if Trump is so willing to throw half his constituency under the bus because he saw a photograph on TV, allegedly, there's a real danger that he's going to throw the other half of his constituency, the domestic constituency, under the bus, so that he's going to abandon his commitment to environmental law reform. It does not look like he's going to do that. There was some kerfluffle. He issued an executive order recently, a number of them dealing with the environment, and he did not explicitly denounce the endangerment finding, which had been underpinning the EPA's efforts to police carbon dioxide emissions. And people were hoping he would issue stronger language than that. There may be legal reasons for that, but it seems like he's got a pretty good team of climate skeptics in there, and they're going to march forward with this. They're going to get America out of the Paris agreements. They are going to dramatically downsize the EPA. They are going to end the war on coal, hopefully. But, you know, the same sort of forces that were working on Trump on the foreign policy front are grinding away on him on the domestic front.
Mm.
So the worrisome part is we might see, you know, another 180-degree turn. We end up with, you know, the uniparty. You know, it's basically Hillary Clinton all over again. That's a real fear now, because that was such a stark reversal of his stated promises and policies.
Right, and he's kind of he's kind of angling in the direction of reform right now with some of the EPA stuff he's done and he's done a lot with air quality, but with coal and whatnot. He's sending some signals that he's going to maybe do some reform.
Well, he's calling for a 31% reduction in the EPA budget, which is a start.
Right.
He's calling for a review, which they're going to, because the environmentalists are so far ahead of the game. They sort of integrate their agenda through dozens of different bureaucracies.
They own the game.
Yes.
They're trying to cull all these bureaucracies now and find out exactly if we really wanted to cut climate out of the U.S. federal government, where would that happen? Like there's the National Association of Ocean Air and Oceanography it's NASA and it's the National Science Foundation, it's the EPA, it's a lot of other government bureaucracies have got these little climate departments.
Well, they stopped,
that have been working away on this agenda.
Well, they stopped the one BLM regulation that was going to shift. Gosh, I don't have that at my fingertips, but it was going to shift the BLM focus from land management to something that had to do with all this climate stuff, and that is
the waters of the U.S.
That is really terrible reporting on my part.
Waters of the U.S. That's another one.
Yeah,
that was a different one.
So he's issued a lot of what appear to be positive stuff. Whether he can get it through Congress, and like people like Scott Pruitt and Perry and Zinke, he's got a lot of people in there who have a history of making very enviro skeptical, climate skeptical statements. So far, there's really no grounds to believe that he's about to do a major reversal on this. However, the whole climate thing, a lot of this environmental stuff, is integrated into the foreign affairs stuff.
Right.
So there's a lot of foreign countries, particularly the European Union, who are really going to be unhappy if the Americans make a decisive break from the whole climate agenda.
Oh, we've talked about that. They're totally invested in that, and they can't, for them to do a reversal would be disastrous at this point, wouldn't it?
Yes. That they'll be, cutting off one of the legs of the chair they're sitting on. But then they don't have the fossil fuel reserves that we have in North America. It sort of makes sense for them. But America's got a military industrial complex. Europe has got an ecological industrial complex. It's a major employer, millions with an S on the end of people who are employed in one level or another of their whole green industry structure in Europe. So it's too big to die sort of thing. Yeah, they've got that going on. But if the whole reason why he returned to sort of the Democratic Party agenda on foreign policy was to sort of, appease the deep state, then he might do it for the same reasons. I mean, it's the path of least resistance for him is to sort of go with the flow, stay in the Paris Agreement, at least give lip service to these sorts of things, perhaps pay less but pay a little, try to make it appear as though he's pulling back but letting things sort of roll ahead. That's the danger. I was someone who was thrilled when he got elected. I thought it was a major breakthrough. But circa April the 7th, and that suddenly changed for me and for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've seen, in the past, all the past presidents, as far as using the Congressional Review Act to roll back regulation, George Bush rolled back one. Now, when you look at the volume of regulation, there were like some 600 major regulations,
right,
with an economic impact estimated at about $740 billion. So far, he has rolled back 11 of those and has two in the hopper, and he has until the end of the month to utilize that. That doesn't require congressional approval.
But also, he said for every new regulation, you have to get rid of three. Wasn't that something else he
two
did?
Two or three.
I remember hearing something about that.
Yeah.
That if Congress wants to impose a regulation in one spot, they've got to reduce something elsewhere.
Well, right. See, that's the thing. Congress doesn't impose the regulation. That's where it becomes incredibly important.
It's the bureaucracy.
Right. because Congress makes the laws, and then the bureaucrats figure out how to make the law, you know, hit the ground.
Applicable,
you know. So they figure out how it's going to roll out. But the bad part has been, over the last 8 years, you know, whether Congress makes a law or not, the bureaucracy is kind of running away. And if you don't have a president who keeps that in check, you're in big trouble.
Well, it's this whole issue of the deep state.
Right.
That within the government, there are these entrenched bureaucrats who make very high salaries, who on a daily basis interact with people, you know, in big business and in academia, and who have great contempt for the electorate. And they think that they know better, and they are resistant to change. And there's a long history, certainly in Canada, you know, our cabinet members have to be elected members. So, like, our cabinet members in the federal government would also have to be congressmen. Hmm. And quite often these people are not well-versed in bureaucracy. And the senior bureaucrats, the deep state, have got a science down. You know, they get a new cabinet minister. On the first day they show up and they drop off, you know, 10,000 pages of regulations that he's got to read and understand in order so that he can be the minister of corrections or whatever.
Oh.
And typically cabinet ministers don't hold the job for very long. So by the time these guys start figuring out exactly what's going on within this department, they're replaced.
Do they have
and you know, you end up with this sort of this deep state that's really running the government, that's interacting with the media. It's a very non-democratic sort of system.
It's kind of interesting because we wind up with that here, especially in states like California that have term limits, because the bureaucrats spend their entire career there.
Yes.
But the elected people are in and out in now 12 years, which seems like a very long time. But there's so much to figure out, and by the time you get halfway good at it, you're on your way, you know, you're on the backside of that term, and the other guys are still there for another 20 years. How about this?
And there's a lack of transparency. You know, it's like pulling teeth. Like, we always have to sue the government to get information out of them.
We have that sometimes, and a lot of times we just don't. If the executive branch really isn't super responsive to the people, like here in California, they have a super majority. So the Democrats have a super majority. They can do basically whatever they want. There's no way for the Republican side or the independents, if there are any, I don't know of any, but they don't have the ability to slow them down. So they wind up kind of runaway train, and the only way people have the ability to stop them is by putting initiatives on the ballot. However,
yeah, but can't the new department heads that are appointed by the president move into
at the
these
federal level.
At the federal level, move in and start reassigning these folks getting them out of there?
Yeah, they can start doing a lot of that. That's always the big fear.
That's what they're going to have to
do. You get a big regime change like Trump rolls into town, and that's why they want to slow down the cabinet appointments and all that. That's the whole point.
Right.
That's also why they put a moratorium on the different bureaucracies communicating with the media and that sort of thing, because they didn't want a disinformation campaign going on while they were trying to get the heads of these departments in place, all the cabinet members.
Right.
It's a tricky deal. We've got
I
to
think
take
a lot
a really
of this is
quick...
going to end up in the United States in front of the Supreme Court. It seems to me that a lot...
Some will.
These people are being appointed cabinet members. I mean, there's like Pruitt in charge of the EPA.
Yes.
And people are saying, no, you don't have the right to dramatically cut back on your staff. Legal precedents in place where you must administer this regulation the way it is currently stated. Yeah. There were all these sort of, with the EPA, under the previous administrations, there was this whole business of sue and settle. The EPA would collude with an environmental group like, you know, Natural Resources Defense Council or Sierra Club. The Sierra Club would sue the EPA and say that you're not doing your job. You know, this regulation specifies that you clean up this lake. You know, you prevent this dam from being built, what have you. And the EPA would pretend to be defending the suit, but then the two parties would agree to a settlement outside of court, and a judge would rubber stamp that. The judgment would then serve as a pretext for the EPA to expand its authority. And they did this on hundreds of occasions, and it was a mechanism whereby the EPA greatly expanded its authority.
Yes.
With this endangerment finding, you know, where the EPA is supposed to suppress a carbon dioxide, they've got a judge's decision. Not only first, you know, they got a Supreme Court decision saying that the EPA could police carbon dioxide. Then the EPA came out with its endangerment finding. That went to court because an environmental group sued the EPA saying they weren't doing enough to, you know, suppress CO2 emissions. Then they got a judgment from a D.C. court saying that, yeah, you must do more to do this. So the debate is, can Pruitt right now, in his current capacity, say, no, I am not going to enforce that regulation? Or does he have the capacity just to veto that regulation? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, see, at the end
I think a lot of those questions are going to go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Probably, but at the end of the day, if there is still a law in place that requires that regulation be carried out, he doesn't have the ability to change law, although in the past, I mean, I say that kind of laughing up my sleeve because in the last 8 years they did that a lot. We have to take a really quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking about this. Because
let's talk about the difference between a law and a regulation, because the regulations, they can change.
Right, as long as it doesn't de facto change the law, huh?
Yeah. Damn.
Tricky stuff. We'll be back with our guest, William Kay. You're listening to We the People Radio.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Welcome back. Having a little fun in the chat room, finally. The chat room's working today. Ta-da! So if you listen live, we are live Sundays from noon to 2. And, of course, any other time, you can catch us on the commercial-free archive, wethepeopleradio.us. And if these are topics your friends are interested in, friends or family or whatever, shoot it to them on Facebook or Twitter. And if you read things or listen to people and you think, gosh, I'd like to hear more from that person, please send that to us. Our email addresses and phone numbers are right there on the website, wethepeopleradio.us.
There you have it.
Ta-da! Little internal commercial there. Because I was just thinking about how much fun it would be to, we need to widen our net. We need to capture some more ideas. But, William, during the break we were talking about the idea of laws versus regulation and how all this environmental stuff will roll out. So we've seen it go one of two ways. I know with the VA, there's a good example there. Congress passed a law allowing veterans to utilize outside care outside the Veterans Administration under a set of parameters and whatnot. But the Veterans Administration was responsible for rolling out the regulation that made that happen, right? Hiring the provider that would do that, figuring out how the whole program would be administered. Well, interestingly enough, they didn't want that, really. It was there to kind of press them on the wait times that were happening for appointments and whatnot. So the VA, this was, 4 years ago or so, said, we're not happy being pressured for this, so we're going to find somebody who's ill-equipped to roll this program out. They needed 3,000 employees, roughly, to make it happen. They were down to 300. So the guys they hired were wildly understaffed, and the whole thing was like sending a car off the assembly line with square wheels. So it can go both ways. I mean, on the one hand, the bureaucracy or the deep state can, regulate the heck out of everything, or they can purposely fumble the ball and frustrate the law from going into effect.
Well, the issue, I think, facing America right now, which we were talking about before the ad, was how easy is it to get rid of regulations? I mean, is it simply a matter for the head of the bureaucracy to say, okay, delete that, delete that? If there's been judgments already granted from courts compelling that particular ministry to go forward. I'm just going through the EPA website, and they give you the three steps of the regulation, but it stops with the codification. There's no, like, what do you do to get rid of this regulation? They don't even think about that. I mean, once we got them, they're part of the Constitution as far as they're concerned. I'll tell you where it's a huge issue is in the United States, the Antiquities Act.
Yes.
Oh, that's horrible.
Where they create
yeah.
these massive parks.
Yep.
And almost every president does these sort of, you know, midnight declarations as they're going out the door, and they create these humongous parks.
The monuments.
Where there's going to be no mining, settling, what have you. Obama did it in Utah, over a million acres, called the Bears Ears National Monument. They all do this. He did another one in Alaska.
They did
and as
one.
As soon as Trump got there, everybody was saying, well, why doesn't he just rescind it? I mean, it's just a...
You know, it's kind of interesting with that. That is actually something that's in my wheelhouse a little bit. Okay, so anything that is created as a national monument already was public land, either managed by BLM or Forest Service. So they don't take private property to do that. But once you turn it into a monument, your utilization, any minerals... that are extracted, all those things, the utilization changes dramatically and is heavily, heavily restricted. So most people really hate it when that comes to a public land mass near them, which is
the
horrible.
The legal question is,
but you can't just,
why cannot another president just undo that
and
throw the open area for a resource development? It's never happened.
Right. They're working on it. They're not. It's funny because the Antiquities Act shows, and it's really, I think, a misuse of the Antiquities Act, but it's easy to tie it up as a monument, but just reversing it is kind of it's an unknown quantity at this point. Does it need legislation?
How could it be any more difficult to reverse it? I mean, if it just was a stroke of a pen to put it in.
Because constitutionally, there's nothing in there to take it out. It was only to put in, which is a bad answer. But
I don't think the word constitution is right there. I mean, basically, if you're allowing one president to do that,
right.
and no other president can undo it, then he's changing the constitution.
It doesn't really say
he doesn't
no
have
other
the right for all time in the future. And this is the argument that I would make to the Supreme Court.
Sure.
Is the one, this is an act of the president. This isn't an act of the whole Congress to, you know, if he's saying, okay, no one's ever going to drill for oil in northern Alaska again, like the,
right.
for all perpetuity. I don't see how any president, elected president, has the authority to do that. For all times, no one's ever going to mine in Utah again.
Yes, and I don't know. They
that seems unconstitutional that a president would have those powers. It seems to be in keeping with the Constitution that another president elected later could reverse that decision.
Yeah, you would think. They just haven't done it. That's the trick, is it hasn't been...
That's the old...
It's not that it...
We've never done it that way before.
Which isn't to say that they won't.
No.
Again.
Well, they absolutely should. There's some absolute treasures of coal and oil that are being stuck inside these monuments that would be a great benefit to the American economy.
Well, California yes. has natural resources greater than some countries in the Middle East, but we can't touch them. It's crazy because we do have the technology to do it safely and reap the benefits, but it's fossil fuels. And, boy, that's
yeah.
like the big no-no anymore. We've got to kind of change our thinking on that because we can burn
yes.
fossil fuels in a clean manner.
Right. Yeah, of course we can.
Yeah.
Well, I'm firmly in the camp that CO2 emissions are good for the atmosphere. They're good for plant life. They are having a negligible effect on the temperature, and that a slightly warming planet is much preferable to a cooling planet. I do not for one New York second think that human emissions of CO2 are a bad thing.
No. And, you know, we always go through with that same example about the CO2, you know, the ambient CO2 in any given space is about 400 parts per million. But if you...
That's outdoors, yeah.
Right. But if you perform mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on someone, you breathe into them 40,000 parts per million.
Yeah, but Leonardo DiCaprio will disagree with that. And he's really a smart guy.
He's like a scientist, only different.
No one's saying that the higher CO2 levels are causing people to suffocate people. They're simply saying they're trapping heat bouncing off the earth. Like, yeah, certainly in a submarine or an elevator, CO2 levels are vastly higher than they are outdoors. Like, you know, 20, 30 times higher. But even that is of no harm to human health. But the global warming argument isn't that we're, you know, somehow denying ourselves oxygen. They're saying that these trace amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere are trapping heat, and this is, you know, frying the planet. And for that, there is no compelling evidence.
No. But don't all scientists, 98% of them, agree that that's...
the figure they kick around is 97%.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's been four different studies they've done, and somehow they've all miraculously come to the same number, 97%.
Isn't that
awesome? You can go online. Each one of those studies has been thoroughly debunked. One of them was a survey of 10,000 scientists. Only 3,000 responded. Half of them did not believe in catastrophic global warming. So they winnowed the number down just to those who are professional climatologists, just to the ones that were actually on the gravy train. We're only going to pay attention to them.
Right.
And they got the 97% figure. Another study, they just read abstracts from 1,000 different climatology papers. But the question they were looking for was not catastrophic, you know, human-caused global warming. The issue was simply, are human emissions having some effect on the weather? And they came once again miraculously to the 97% figure. There's been four different ways that the global warmers have somehow always end up with this 97% consensus figure. You can go online. I can find you petitions signed by over 25,000 scientists who categorically deny the catastrophic human-caused global warming hypothesis. There's been petition after petition signed by that. There is no consensus. What you have is a manufactured consensus where billions of dollars of government money spent in Europe and the United States have mobilized this army of guys in white lab jackets who are preachers of the global warming doctrine, and they managed to dominate one small branch of science. But their hypothesis is absurd, and the bloom is off the rose.
Although, I guarantee you... At any town hall across the country, we'll have a whole host of screaming memes who will be lecturing us on 97% again. We need to take a really quick break.
You'll hear that number over and over again.
I know.
It's another bogus factoid from those people.
It's just frustrating.
We
need to take a really quick
break. The EPA director is a skeptic, and that's the good news.
That is, and that's, I think, going to be helpful. We'll be right back. We need to take a quick break. We're on with our guest, William Kay, out of Alberta, Canada, and we'll be rejoining you here in just a couple minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Didn't he invent rap, Bob? Was that MC Hammer?
Oh, he was one of the early pioneers, practitioners, yes.
Practitioners, thank you.
You could actually understand him and nobody got hurt.
I think the Sugar Hill Gang is widely credited with inventing modern-day rap.
Never heard of it.
Or you know, introducing it on a mass appeal scale.
See, you never thought you'd get rap trivia here on We the People Radio. Yeah, we are well versed.
I thought it was the Capitol Hill gang singing "Don't Touch This."
Yeah, there you go.
New wilderness legislation.
New wilderness legislation. So, okay, so William, as far as environmental policy goes, and the new Trump guys. Okay, so EPA rollback, that's going to be super important, that needs to keep happening.
It's a start. They could actually shut down like 99% of that bureaucracy and America would be better off.
Well, no kidding. I mean, not every state actually has their own EPA, but bunches do. So we're all, those of us living in states with our own EPA just get hammered twice.
Mm-hmm. All you really need is a federal bureaucracy that sort of coordinates local EPAs, and all they really should concern themselves with is air and water quality that people are actually drinking and breathing. I could see the reason for that.
Sure.
You know, we had the famous lodgepole blowout in Alberta about 20 years ago where they were drilling for oil and they hit a sulfur gas deposit. And killed the riggers, and then this cloud of sulfur gas floated across the province. It's good to have, you know, some sort of warning system that could alert people to that. But that's all you need. A very small team of technicians that are
right.
Periodically checking the air and the water, make sure no one's being poisoned. But 17,000 bureaucrats, you don't need that. Federally, you just need a small team. It's coordinating local efforts.
Yeah, and
all
you
they're
see that,
doing is suppressing economic activity.
Yeah, and you see that a lot where you have an incident, and so we have to develop an entire body of another department of government to regulate because we had one accident.
Well, you know, I mean, of course, there's a huge outcry now that there's any sort of, you know, EPA rollback being even discussed. I mean, now we're going to be like China.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you get rid of one rule, and all of a sudden we're all going to...
People are freaking out. Oh, yeah, we're going to... The environmental community is freaking out. We're going to be like China here any day.
Well, 31% of 17,000, you know, that's over 5,000 people are going to get walking papers. I can see why the environmental movement's freaking out. That sort of thing should be replicated. So many of them now, you know, it was a social movement, but so many of them have migrated into government.
Yes.
It has embedded itself deeply in the government and is now,
And vice versa.
You know, in the universities and what have you, there's, you know, tens upon tens of thousands of professional environmentalists.
Well, and you look at the, you know, Sierra Club and Defenders of Wildlife and all these guys that are supposed to be advocacy organizations, but they are funded in large part by government money.
They get government money and they get big green money. A lot of these wealthy philanthropic organizations, you know, the Rockefeller Brothers and the Pew family and,
sure.
and the MacArthur Foundation also pump, you know, probably. There's a, go on, online, there's a group called the Environmental Grant Makers Association, and that's a sampling. It's not the full amount of money moving from big philanthropists into the NGO community, but that's probably $2 billion a year. But you are right. Like, it's like any social movement. It could be started in the private sector, but gradually it migrates into the public sector. The more it gains political influence, the more it can tap various bureaucracies at various levels, and they're very successful at doing that. You know, there's like the Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Park Service and the Forest Service and all these other bureaucracies that the NGOs have tapped into and get grants from.
Mm-hmm.
But they've integrated themselves into sort of a solid organizational complex. And they've done this in other countries as well. They were at one point, you know, a social movement far more on the margins, even though they were elite sponsored. It was very wealthy people at the nucleus of it. Over the last 40 or 50 years, they have deeply embedded themselves into governments at all levels, and particularly into the university structure. So they are now almost a parallel government.
Yeah, which was really a smart move because it's working out very well for them. We've got a caller with a question. We got Billy Bob on the line. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Are you there?
Yes, we're here. You're loud and clear, buddy. What's happening?
All right. Great show, Bill and Aaron. You guys do a wonderful job. I listen to you every weekend. And listen, the prompted my call was that why does it take, and my compliments and hats off to you, William, how does it take a Canadian to be so much smarter than 80 or 85% of Americans? I mean, this is unbelievable how much William knows and his expertise. And I just wanted to call and thank him for his attention to our matters. And we're going to bring him in here as a senator of Ontario. Okay, buddy, I'll let you go.
Thanks, Billy Bob. Well, it's true, though.
William, you're making Canadians proud.
Okay. Well, maybe it helps to be sort of a bit of an outsider. I find people have a hard time, criticizing your own government or looking at your own government. You don't want to come across as being unpatriotic. It might help to be sort of slightly out of the picture to really look at things.
Yeah. It's really helpful because you get a different, you get a very different look at it. You know, you're not bombarded with it all day, every day. And you get a different, different sources. I'd be really excited to post on the page for today if you would send me what you some of the things you use for research. Some of the places that you go to find things and you find their information is pretty truthful. I'm always being asked, who's actually telling the truth? No one's ever 100% right, but I'd love to know some of your guys that you actually trust.
Yeah, okay. It could be a long list. I do a lot of reading, and, the key is, that's the key, and sort of triangulate, and over time you sort of develop your own sort of bullshit detector, you sort of know what's true and what isn't almost at first glance. But about the Canadian Senate, just to go, you guys, you don't have it so bad down there. In Canada, our Senate is not elected.
We have
a Senate that's actually appointed and appointed for life.
Oh, how many?
Canada is a monarchy,
really?
Okay?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Our head of state, even though, in reality, our head of state is the prime minister. In law, our head of state is the governor general, who is the direct appointee of the Queen of England.
That brings up
have two houses of parliament, the House of Commons and the House of Senate, and the Senate in Canada is not elected. Just like in Britain, they've got a House of Lords,
right.
Unelected. They keep reducing its power. Like now all it can do is sort of tie up legislations for a few years. But there's been a movement in Canada, as long as I can remember, why don't we have an elected Senate? Why don't we have an elected president instead of a governor general? We're still stuck. We're stuck in, the 14th century here.
Well, why I got a question. Why, if you were a
territory, take a break while Bill gets his new lips calibrated.
You were a territory of England at one time. Why is French the second language in Canada?
Well, because what was called Lower Canada, or Quebec, was a French colony. During the Seven Years' War, at the Plains of Abraham, outside of Montreal, the British, under General Wolfe, defeated the French General Montcalm.
Huh.
Both generals dying in combat.
Oh, dear.
But the British prevailed, and part of the saw-off deal was it would be a union of the two peoples.
Okay.
So we've never really gotten away from that. And when, the devil himself, Pierre Trudeau, was prime minister, he made bilingualism a constitutional provision when we repatriated the Constitution.
Yeah.
So now you go to British Columbia, which is the province to the west, north of Washington State. The French language is the eighth most common language spoken amongst the people.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese is more spoken. Filipino is more spoken. There are no French people. Once you go west of Toronto, there's no French people at all. But
really?
Every province has to have all these bilingual programs.
Yeah.
All the laws are written in French and English. It's an endless source of irritation to non-French people. and yet you cannot, you know, be a prime minister in this country unless you're fluently French, which means we endlessly have these Quebecois prime ministers. And as been pointed out, you can only rise so high in the federal civil service. If you're unilingual, you've got to be bilingual. But nobody outside of Quebec speaks French.
Yeah.
So it's
kind of hit a nerve there.
Oh, tell me about it. It's almost a there's this French conspiracy to take over Canada. That's what you tell. It's called the Laurentians.
Yeah.
They live along the Gulf of St. Lawrence. But it's a really touchy issue in Canada because there's absolutely no point for places like Alberta to have bilingualist government policies. Nobody speaks French here. Nobody.
Huh.
More people speak German in this province. More people speak Ukrainian than French in this province.
Oh my God. Well, that's pretty bad.
Well, I won't mention that.
I had to change the name of the show because we were saying, a Canadian view of U.S. foreign policy. So I just changed it to a Canadian view of stuff in the U.S. we've been like all over the place with this. Our show has no topic, which is really fun. I like it. We've got to take a really swift break. And just a program note that the word that starts with B and ends with T can't be said on the air. So Bob had to do some quick push the secret button. And
is he that fast?
Oh,
yes,
he's
it
quick.
Was unbelievable. He was like cat quick.
Boom!
We've never seen.
Get back. I'm going to test him.
We've never seen it happen before. We don't know. We don't even know what it sounded like. It sounded like pshh, like that. So I don't know. It's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd explain what that weird noise was that other people heard.
Now, if you're listening later on the replay on the website and the archives, you can hear what he said.
Oh, it doesn't make the sound.
We just can't broadcast it over the air and terrestrial radio,
right?
According to the
American
FCC. Yes.
Okay.
Interesting.
There you go.
There you have it. I just thought I should probably explain what that weird noise was. Anyway. We'll take a really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, William Kay, while we talk about more stuff.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing? When you don't believe a word I say, we can't go on together with suspicious.
Shot him with a boo. Bob.
So what if it's Easter Sunday? We've used the
the magic, dump button.
The magical dump button for the first time. We're playing Weird Al. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gotta love hanging out with the Canadians. thanks, William. This has been...
Oh, my pleasure.
This has been super fun.
I just wanted to plug the website.
Yes, please. I forgot.
www.ecofascism.com. Always new stuff coming out. Plus, I've been experimenting with YouTube lately.
You have. You've got a lot of stuff
you just
on there.
Google my name, William K, and then Ecofascism. I did two or three myself. I did a bunch of interviews with a guy as well. There's more of that coming. I've got to really improve my technical skills a little bit, but I did one that is just so controversial that I haven't even posted it yet.
Oh, get it up. Yeah.
What's the topic?
Yeah. Well, it's really is very, very critical of the Pope.
And that's easy to do.
That's going to irritate people. And I'm going to do it for sure. And the next written posting is all going to be about land economics and how it comes to pass that housing prices are so exorbitant in many cities because the environmental movement has pulled so much land out of development and how they've surrounded all these cities with green belts. And this is obviously an effort to do what it is doing, which is driving up the price of commercial real estate and residential real estate to very unaffordable levels. And this isn't an accident.
And forcing people to live in rabbit hutches.
Well, yes. We just keep seeing...
And it's forcing its impact in the whole economy. I mean, there's studies saying that if they would just... You know, like Houston is the role model where they really just let the city sprawl and spread. And the housing costs remain very low there. And it's not as though there's any shortage of land in North America. Like some of the worst cities in the world for this sort of confined cities are Australia and Canada. Like the cities of Toronto and Vancouver are notorious. They created an area... 40,000 square kilometers. Think 15,000 to 18,000 square miles of land they took out of development around Vancouver. And it has now got the most unaffordable housing in the world. And it's next to Hong Kong.
I'll testify to what you're saying is true. We have relations that live in Texas, and one of them lives in a house that is like a palatial mansion, would cost probably $2 million in California.
Well, moved from the California Bay Area, sold a house, moved there.
Paid cash.
Yeah.
It'd be a $2 million home easy here.
One of the big real estate companies in the States took a standard house, four-bedroom, 2,200-square-foot house, and put it in different cities and checked out the price. Houston, $230,000. San Francisco, $1.5
million. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great comparison, yeah.
And the difference is land use planning. Because even around these coastal cities, like there's 1,000 square miles around Portland, Oregon, that's been taken out of development. Mm. And even places like San Francisco, there's room to grow for these cities, but they've all been zoned out of development.
Yeah, that
makes
perfect sense.
But this isn't an accident. I mean, the people who own the commercial real estate, the big landlords in the city, they want it that way. They really want to restrict access to new land. They like what it's doing. Like most businesses are our tenants. Most businesses do not own the premises out of which they operate. You know, dentists and coffee shops bars. They're usually tenants.
Mm-hmm.
And the owners of that commercial real estate, they don't want to see wide open capitalism. They don't want to throw open the city's fringe regions to development because all sorts of new commercial real estate would pop up along with new apartment blocks.
Hey, we'll get those new videos up, William. We're looking forward to seeing them, and we do appreciate you coming on. We're out of time, but
send them our way, and we can always post them on today's page because we have a lot of
people. Thank you very much for having.
Yeah.
Over and out.
And out. Our guest, William Kay. Always a fun ride. Thanks a lot, guys. It's been a great day. See you next week.
Happy Easter.
Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Happy Easter from Casey at our Shasta Reading.